I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. How are you feeling? No, really, how are you feeling? It's a question we get asked a lot, and we generally say fine, even if it's not true, even if we don't know what we are feeling. Our guest, psychologist Mark Brackett, has made that question the center of his professional and personal life. He reveals in his book, Permission to Feel, that he grew up in an emotionally clueless family. His parents unable to deal with their emotions and his. He was a lonely, unhappy, and angry kid with a scary and disturbing secret. He was being sexually abused by a neighbor. He had bottled up his feelings until an uncle asked him and was genuinely interested in the answer, "How are you feeling?" That heartfelt question opened up a flood of emotions and helped Mark Brackett better understand himself, which led him eventually to found the Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University, where he is a professor in the Child Study Center. And he joins us today on The Connection to talk about how to connect with our emotional life and how it can enhance our relationship with ourselves and with others. Mark Brackett, nice to have you with us on the show.
And it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. I included a very short synopsis of your personal story, but I want to begin with you and begin with 10-year-old you. If we were to have met you whenever you were 10 years old, how many years ago that was, what would have been our impression of you? How would we have described you?
So that would have been almost 45 years ago now. And I think you would have seen a child who was struggling. You know, I was not doing well in school. I was confused. I was angry. I was scared. And as you shared, you know, I was sadly being abused for a number of years by one of my parents' closest friends who was a neighbor. Mm-hmm. And didn't share what was happening to me. My family was going through a lot themselves, my parents. And I think having a mom who was very anxious and kind of having a nervous breakdown quite often, as they called it back then, and my father kind of just trying to make ends meet and survive, had a lot of anger and was that stereotypical kind of, we call it toxically masculine father, you know, like, son, you got to toughen up. I just repressed, suppressed, denied, ignored, you know, ate my feelings. And I hope that gives you a picture.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as I read it and as I hear you describe it, I mean, it's sad to hear a child to be so lonely and alone, but you did have this uncle Marvin, who it seemed like you had a pretty good relationship with, and he asked you this question, Mark, how are you feeling? Was it something about his relationship or the way he asked the question or his interest in the answer that allowed you to open up your feelings?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you ask it that way, because ever since I wrote my book, which is called Permission to Feel and dedicated to my uncle, I've done research on the notion of having a feelings mentor, or, you know, do people have someone in their lives, you know, that create the conditions for them to be their true, full feeling self? And I just want to say up front that only about a third of the thousands of people I've studied across the United States and in other countries say they had someone like that. And so I think it's a missing piece. And what I'll say about my uncle is that, you know, he created the conditions. And what does that mean exactly? Well, he was non-judgmental. He was a good listener. He showed empathy and compassion. And so when I shared what was going on for me, he didn't say toughen up or I can't handle this or you should do this. He said, you know, we're going to get through this together. And that's exactly what happened. And so I don't know if it was his facial expression, his tone of voice, his overarching presence, but it was, I guess, all of that that created the conditions for me to feel like I could share what was happening.
I mean, that sounds like a critical turning point in your life.
I mean, I dedicate, you know, my mental health and well-being to my relationship with my uncle, and he gave me a career because my uncle was an amazing human being. He was a middle school teacher in the Catskill Mountains of New York State, and he was a band leader by night. And I think that was also what made him kind of magical, because he was a musician, by night and a teacher by day. And interesting thing about Uncle Marvin is that he said, when I'm playing the shows at night, everybody's feeling it. And then when I go teach my sixth grade social studies class, nobody's feeling it. And he realized that the missing link in education was emotion, feeling, that we have to, kids have to want to feel like being in school, and they need to be inspired and curious. And anyway, that was just an amazing thing for me to have, had in my life.
Well, and
And go ahead.
no, I'm sorry. It does raise a whole host of questions about, similar kids today, who might be dealing with difficult situations, who look like they're angry, but inside they're a frightened little boy or girl. And the fact that I think that a lot of people just don't know what they are feeling, that they are truly cut off from their feelings.
They are. It's interesting. We'll just jump now from like my 10-year-old boy to like me being, a presenter running around the world giving speeches to big companies. And I ask, hundreds, if not thousands of people a month, leaders in big organizations, what's the difference between anxiety, stress, and fear and overwhelm? And do you know that, I mean, maybe one or two people in the last couple of years have gotten it right?
Well,
I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of people that I've presented to. And a lot of people say things like, well, it doesn't matter. It's all the same thing. And as a scientist of emotion, I'm going to tell you right now, it is not the same thing, that we have to be granular. We want to be precise about how we're feeling, because when we have that clarity, it helps guide us to the strategies to deal with our feelings.
there's a lot of focus, and I think rightfully so, on the brain, on cognition, on cognitive behavioral therapy. And I think these are important things that we need to understand. But I wonder whether emotions or even emotional intelligence has taken a back seat to some of these developments because you can't quantify it. You can't slide it under a microscope.
Well, it's a great point. It's something that we at our center think about a lot. I think what you're really also talking about is that we're a society that is intervention focused. We wait for bad things to happen to people and then we try to fix them. We wait for people to have their, bout of depression. We wait for people to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. And then we say, oh, now you go for your cognitive behavior therapy or other treatments, which, by the way, is important. But my position on all this is that we need to think like prevention scientists. We need to think, what are the skills? What are the conditions that we need to create for young children and adolescents and even, young adults? What do they need to be able to know and do to prevent mental health challenges? And I can tell you from our research and others' research that when we have more developed emotional intelligence, when we're better able to recognize our emotions and understand them and label them and express them and regulate them, our lives are just better.
And I do want to get to all of that, but let me ask you kind of a broad-based question. So do you think of emotional intelligence, EQ as it is described, or the letters are, do you think that's as important as IQ?
I do. I wouldn't have a career otherwise. But I'm serious about that. I'm not, I work at a university, right? That's very high powered, where everybody has high IQ. You can't get in without the high IQ. And, years ago, I just assumed that that was the ticket to success. And it's not, because yes, we want people who can problem solve, who can think critically and creatively. Very important. But we need people who also know how to deal with their own and other people's emotions. We need people who can take feedback well and process it and not get defensive. We need people who can lead a meeting and make people feel inspired. We need people who can deal with conflict in relationships and know how to say, I'm sorry, and ask for forgiveness and move forward. That's a big part of our life. And I'm here to tell you that it's the missing piece in education.
Education and probably the workplace and even beyond. You write that we should think of our emotions as a form of education or as a form of information, I should say. Reports from the psyche, as you describe it.
I That's my take.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not my opinion, by the way. I always tell people, like, yes, I have strong opinions about a lot of this stuff. But, my day job is a scientist. And I think it's very important for listeners to know that our emotion system, we have it for a reason. There are five things that I speak about. The first is our attention. So, for example, if people are bored with our conversation, which I hope they're not, they're going to turn off, right? Because they're not going to feel engaged. And that's an emotion. And so emotions drive where we pay our attention. The second is that emotions drive our judgments and our decisions. How we feel, determines the quality of the choices we make about what we eat and whether or not we exercise, whether we're kind or nasty to someone. The third is related, which is relationships. I always say that emotions are signals. They tell us to approach or avoid. So Uncle Marvin, who we spoke about, he had a facial expression, a vocal tone, and a posture that said, approach, I'm here to listen. We all know people whose facial expressions say otherwise. The fourth, mental health. Little feelings become big feelings if we don't know how to deal with them. And finally, the big one that, people in the corporate world care about and in education is just performance, whether it's academic or workplace. When you think about being successful in life, there's a lot of failure associated with it. There's, like I said, feedback, there's frustration, there's overwhelm, there's uncertainty. And if we don't have the feelings, or I'm sorry, if we don't have the strategies to deal with those feelings, oftentimes the most brilliant among us don't achieve our dreams because the emotions get in the way.
About a minute before our first break here, but emotions, as you write and as we know, they are messy, they're confusing, they are uncomfortable. I mean, the impulse is to push them away, to deny them.
Unfortunately, but that's why we have a Center for Emotional Intelligence, because we're trying to make a change. And I think it's because they're scary, they're messy, because people have not been educated about them. And my vision is that we create a formal education for all children from preschool to high school and beyond in a developmentally appropriate way to support them in learning about their emotions and how to use those emotions wisely to achieve their goals.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And our guest today on The Connection is psychologist Mark Brackett. He's the founding director of the Center for Emotional Intelligence. That's at Yale University. Author of a book written just a while ago titled Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we are talking about our emotional life. Why it's important to understand and label and get to know our emotional life. And again, our guest is psychologist Mark Brackett, and he's a founding director of the Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University. Mark, we've been talking about emotions, but I'm thinking of the word feelings. I'm thinking of the word affect. And I think we all sort of use them interchangeably. And I don't want to get caught up too much in semantics. But I wonder, when we use these words, how much you think of that is biology and how much you think is biography?
Wow, that's a big one. I do think it's, for scientific purposes, we disentangle these concepts. I think for everyday use, you talk about, how are you feeling, what emotions you're experiencing. We kind of mean just your kind of broad emotional life and experiences. So I would just keep it at that. I'm here to say that counter to most people's beliefs, we We learn about emotions. We are not necessarily born with emotions. And I know that's kind of, what are you talking about? Well, we're born, with a proclivity towards experiencing the world, right? We're going to approach, we're going to avoid, we're going to have sensations. But emotions are concepts that we learn about. I mean, think about it. We have a language, and we've decided that there's a word called angry that means perceived injustice. There's a word called disappointment that means unmet expectation. These are concepts, that have been created, for us. And there are nuances in our cultures, right? If you go to, for example, China, there are about 100 terms just for the concept of shame. We don't have that here in, the United States or in English. And so that is an interesting phenomenon that certain cultures value different experiences more than others.
So that if someone in China is feeling ashamed, is their shame different from the shame you and I might be feeling in this country?
It could be, yeah, because there's more specificity in terms of the types of shame they would be experiencing. So it's like the Inuit, let's say in Canada, who, have, living in freezing weather, they have hundreds of words or dozens of words to describe different forms of rain and different textures of sleet and snow. And so their experience of it is different than our experience of it. We have two words, right? It's snowing, it's hailing.
But so emotion, I mean, we all as human beings share certain emotions, happiness, sadness, the most obvious ones. But how we express those feelings can be very different.
Yeah, and we don't conceive of these things the same everywhere. So, for example, in research with children, if you asked, I work in New Haven, Connecticut. So, if we went to a preschool in New Haven, Connecticut, and we asked a little boy who is in kindergarten to draw a picture of someone who's happy, they would draw this big face with big smile with lots of teeth. If you asked a boy, let's say in Korea, same age, different preschool, but in, South Korea, and they drew a picture of someone happy, you get a more gentle smile without so much teeth coming out. Now, makes you think, does that mean that because they draw a bigger smile in America than in Korea, that the kids are happier in America? Obviously not. It's just that, going back to what you said, we have different conceptions in our minds about what an emotion is and what it looks like that is different necessarily from, the experience of the feeling.
And is the and not to again not to get too deep in here, but let me just do a quick follow-up. But in terms of
Sure.
the biology part of it, the feeling part of it, the flush of red if you feel angry, red in your face, is that, I mean, that's the sort of biological response, yes, or physiological response.
That would be a physiological response, but research would show that it's not a universal physiological response. And so not everybody, I think unfortunately we have created caricatures out of emotion in our society. So you learn these things in, like, kindergarten with these playbooks and these little emoticons, and it's just not the way the human emotion system operates. So not everybody, makes a frown when they are sad. Not everybody gnarls, when they're angry. I mean, have you ever gotten angry with someone at work, and do you make that kind of that? Do you pierce your eyes and purse your lips? You
No,
probably
I do not.
exactly.
That would be
That's what we're
dangerous, yeah.
told. Exactly. So you are taught as a professional, like, to mask your emotions. So even if you're feeling something, you don't display it the way it's stereotypically talked about. Kids are learning that early on in their lives. We learn that as adults. There's cultural nuances there. And so I think the real message of this very confusing concept is that the goal is to get to know people and connect with them. When you live with someone and you've seen, you've heard them on the phone and they get bad news and you see that facial expression, you kind of know, oh, my partner is disappointed. My partner is frustrated. My partner is angry. But we don't want to generalize that to everybody in the world.
I wonder, too, in sort of getting out of this little hole that I dug here for us in terms of definitions, but and picking up on something you just mentioned there, but and maybe speaking about Americans or maybe human beings, is because emotions are messy and confusing, is it easier to, is it our impulse to mask them, to deny them, to not deal with them, because it's going to screw things up?
It's the opposite.
Okay.
It's the opposite.
I hear you. But I'm saying, sort of us untrained people. I mean, is that how we see emotions?
We do. I think most people see emotions as something need to be controlled, right? Control your feelings or they'll control you is an old adage, which is couldn't be further from the truth. The reason why we have an emotional intelligence is that when we learn how to use our emotions wisely, we can achieve all of our goals and dreams in life. And I feel like that's the core message that people need to know, that when we can identify how we're feeling and understand where that feeling is coming from and learn evidence-based strategies to regulate and manage those emotions, everything is possible.
So it's important to literally name or label the emotion that we are feeling so that we, recognize it when it comes again and know how to deal with it out in the world?
Yeah. So let's go back to my example with the executives. So I do this presentation to executives. I ask them, what's the difference between anxiety, stress, and fear? Let's just keep it simple.
Right.
And they say, there's no difference. And I say, well, let's think about it some more. Maybe there is a difference. It's not a rhetorical question. And they say, well, I don't see a difference. I say, okay, how about this? Anxiety is about perceived uncertainty, right? Think about the pandemic. All of a sudden my university shut down, we're spraying our groceries with Windex, right? That was a lot of uncertainty and it caused a lot of anxiety. It wasn't stress. Right. Stress was having too many demands and not enough resources. So, for example, in my career, we didn't know what would happen. But given that people were so anxious, I was getting thousands of emails a day. Can you help us? Because I work with school systems and support them in doing this work. All the teachers are anxious and overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. That made me stressed out. Right. I was stressed now because I had too many demands and I just couldn't respond quickly enough. Fear is about impending danger. Right? That there's a real danger in front of me. So just to make sure we get the differences, uncertainty, too many demands, not enough resources versus impending danger. So then I said to these executives, go back into your groups. Now that I've given you the nuance and the definitions, why would it matter? And then they started thinking, oh, so if I'm anxious, I might need to do this to deal with my anxiety. And if I'm stressed, I might need to do that. I'm like, exactly. So when you're feeling anxious about something that's happening in the world, you're going to have to do some self-talk maybe, right? To help yourself think about it a little differently. Mark, you're safe at home. Mark, you're doing this to take care of your family. Okay. It's going to be okay. When I'm stressed out at work, either I get help or I have to do less, right? There's doing a breathing exercise to reduce my stress is not going to work, right, if I still have too much stuff on my plate.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's psychologist Mark Brackett, and he's the founder of the Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University, where he's a professor in the Child Study Center, and wrote a book relatively recently called Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. Let me just pick up on something else that crossed my mind as you were talking about how emotions can disguise themselves. For instance, anger is often about fear. I mean, the bully at school can be that terrified child at home. How does that make it more challenging to label something when it might be a stand-in for something else?
Yeah, great question. So a couple of things. This is why, in my work, the adults who are raising and teaching children need to have an emotion education first. Because in my opinion, adults need to be feelings mentors and emotion coaches to children. So going back to your example about anger and fear, but we don't want to mix the two. I mean, sometimes we feel both,
right?
But they are different feelings, right? Fear is about danger. Anger is about a perceived injustice. We want to make sure we have that clarity. But here's something interesting, and I'll relate this to my own experience, which hopefully people will understand. So as a kid who was being abused, I was feeling shame and sadness and fear. However, because I didn't disclose it, right? And then I was bullied in school and I was feeling shame, you know, because I was feeling bad about myself. That was part of the reason why I didn't disclose what happened. But I was also embarrassed that I was feeling shame. Do you get what I'm saying? I had
I
a feeling about my feeling. And so that's a big deal, because sometimes the feelings that we have about our feelings are the drivers of what we do or don't do with those feelings. And so, you know, it goes back, this is complicated, but that's okay. As long as we start having language and we start understanding the concepts, it doesn't become complicated any longer. And so going back to this parent coaching or teacher coaching, you know, when a child comes into a classroom, let's say, and is saying, you know, they look like they're angry, they're stomping their feet, they're yelling, you know, I don't want to come to school anymore, I hate this school, right? If we look at it right then and there, we're, oh, the child is angry. But what we're doing is we're making what's called an attribution error. We are attributing the child's behavior to a feeling, but we don't really know what the feeling is. We just know the behavior. The behavior could be anything. It could be shame. It could be anger. It could be fear. It could be embarrassment, because kids mask their feelings, right? For a variety of reasons. So what we have to do is figure out a way to deactivate the child, right? We have to be deactivate ourselves as the parents who are getting triggered by our kids or the teachers. Get in a calm place and then have that real conversation. You know, honey, tell me what happened. And then as the adult listening, what happens is that we start hearing, oh, it's someone made fun of him. Oh, it is feeling of a, it is ashamed. Oh no, someone left him out of the game and was mean and cruel. Oh, he's angry or disappointed. Do you see what I'm getting at here? It's that it's about helping children in this instance deactivate, connect, ask good questions to find out what their experience was, try to tie that to the real emotion, and then be supportive in terms of helping that child deal with that feeling.
You have a word, it's called ruler, R-U-L-E-R, which kind of underscores what you decide or have described as the skills of emotional intelligence, recognizing emotions in oneself and others, understanding the causes and consequences of emotions, labeling emotions with a nuanced vocabulary, expressing emotions in accordance with cultural norms and social context, and regulating emotions with helpful strategies, which sounds very clean and neat, and I know it's difficult to do. But nonetheless, if you can do that, if you can be emotionally intelligent, what do you get?
You get better learning, you get better decision making, you get better relationships, you get better mental health, and you get better goal attainment in terms of, you know, your the things that you want out of life. So that's a lot.
It is a lot. And I wonder whether how much emotional intelligence is tied to things like empathy or resilience or grit. You know, that's a word that is used down here in Philadelphia because of Angela Duckworth. But nonetheless, is there a connection there?
There is, but now we're going to get messy again.
Uh-oh. Okay, go ahead, Mark.
You know, grit is, as Angela is a friend, and so we talk about this a lot. Actually, I interviewed her recently for a web series that I created called Dealing with Feelings, and we had a great conversation. You know, grit is more of a personality trait, right? It's more of a You are someone who is gritty, who, is highly conscientious and motivated. And you'll need emotional intelligence to, when you're gritty and things don't go your way, right? You're going to need the skills of emotional intelligence to deal with those obstacles. So that's interesting combination. Empathy, there's multiple forms of empathy, but we'll keep it simple and say empathy is about, a shared emotional experience, understanding someone's feeling states and kind of relating to it. And that you need to be able to recognize and understand and label emotions to do. Where emotional intelligence comes in really handy with empathy is how to be supportive. So once you feel what someone else is feeling or understand their feelings, they may need help and support. And so they may need strategies to help them deal with their experiences. And that's where the emotional intelligence piece comes in.
And the other one was resilience.
Yeah, that's right. So resilience is another one of those tough terms. I don't love the term in general because it sounds like it's something that you have or don't have. And I don't think of it that way. I think that resilience is a lifelong journey and that the primary driver of our resilience is two things, are two things. The first is community, being around people who are an amazing network that help you grow. And the second is having the emotion regulation strategies, the ability to deal with the obstacles, especially when you're alone.
And we're almost about to break here, another break here, but what we're talking about are skills. You say these are things that can be taught.
100% learned. And I know that people will say, but I thought people are born with these skills. No, no one is born with emotional intelligence. I'm going to say that very loudly. These are skills that have to be learned. No one is born with an area of their brain that has evidence-based strategies to deal with their feelings. No one is born with an emotion vocabulary. It has to be taught. It has to be practiced. It has to be refined.
Well, tell you what, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with psychologist Mark Brackett about emotions, our emotional life. And again, he's founder and director of the Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're taking a pretty deep look at something called emotional intelligence, how to find and how to have a full range of feelings and how that can lead to healthier relationships with others, even with yourself, and also a more satisfied, more productive life. And again, our guest is psychologist Mark Brackett. Mark, you had talked about self-talk, and we all have these voices in our head all the time telling us what to do or how we're doing or what we look like or why we're failing. I mean, they can often be critical voices. But I always wonder, like, who is that person? Who is that person that is talking to me? Is that important?
It is important. Well, it is you.
Right. It is me. Right. Exactly.
Unfortunately, I think most of our negative self-talk is defined for us by others, which is really challenging. I think many of us, have been gaslighted in our childhoods by people who are mean and cruel and want us to think a certain way about ourselves. You're too fat, you're too thin, you're too tall, you're too short, you're too dark, you're too light, your nose is too big, your nose is too small. It's, whatever it is, that people find ways to be mean or cruel to us about. And we don't get any intervention. And so we just start believing it. And that's the beginnings of our negative self-talk, that we start just hearing people say things. No one questions us, no one intervenes, and then all of a sudden it becomes our reality.
Because when we say, oh, we're so stupid, I mean, that was such a stupid thing to do, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
100%. And it breaks my heart, you know. In my book, I tell a story about a niece of mine who was terribly bullied in kindergarten. She is adopted. I'm happy to say she's now a college student, doing fantastic. But she was adopted from Guatemala and lived in an area of the United States where she was the only dark child in the classroom. And unfortunately, a young girl said to her something like this: "You're a different color than your mother. That's disgusting."
Oh.
And I share this because it was one of the hardest moments, you know, being her uncle, given that it was her grandfather that was my Uncle Marvin.
Oh, interesting.
Her mom called me and said, you know, I'm gonna go run over that kid and her mother with my truck. And I'm like, well, let's figure this out. And so road trip, Uncle Mark goes to visit his niece. And you know, it was heartbreaking to see. Here she was at 5 years old. I don't want to go to school anymore. Why am I this? Why am I this? Asking a million questions about her identity, feeling very insecure, not wanting to go to school. And I share this with everyone listening because it is our moral obligation to support children in having healthy self-talk. It is our obligation. It was my obligation. It was her mom's obligation to figure out how to reach this young girl and help her realize that she is beautiful just the way she is, that no one has the right to define who she is or what's good or bad about her. And that was hard work, you know, hence why we want to prevent bullies, right? We want fewer bullies in the world, but we're not going to get rid of all the bullies and mean people. And so, and parents can be mean to their kids too, by the way. What we want to do is help people learn critical skills like emotional intelligence, so that they can monitor their self-talk, ask themselves, you know, is this self-talk working for me or working against me? Wow, this is not really helpful. It's not nice to call myself names all the time. Okay, so what's the alternative? Oh, I can use positive self-talk. I can use affirmations. I can reframe this experience in a positive light. And that's what I want everyone to learn.
And is that sort of a version of what you told your niece to sort of help her? I mean, she's only five, so it's a little more complicated, or maybe less complicated, I don't know. But how did you help her deal with this?
Exactly like I just said, is that we just started having conversations. And she learned very quickly through someone who loved her, who is me, that she's wonderful just the way she is. And that no matter who anyone is, no one can tell you how to think about yourself. That was hard to explain to a five-year-old,
right?
But let me tell you, we did it. And it was through multiple conversations over multiple months. And it worked. And I'm just going to share something else that happened. So a couple of years later, it just so happened Esme at one point also had a little bit of a speech challenge, but she's quite extroverted and she wanted to be in the school play. And she came up to me when we visited and she's like, "Uncle Mark, you know, I want to be in the play, but I'm scared that, you know, I'm going to sound funny and that people are going to make fun of me." All right, now we need a new strategy for that. And we worked on so many different things that she could say to herself to build her confidence and her comfort, you know, in doing the play. Of course, she ended up doing it. And at the end of when she jumped off the stage, she came, "Uncle Mark, you know, I did it." And I was like, "Ez, I'm so proud of you, but I'm just curious, you know, when you got nervous before you went on stage, what was your strategy?" And she goes, "Well, I like the one where I looked up in the sky and I said to myself, Esme, you can face your fears."
That's such a great story.
And honestly, I cry sometimes when I tell that story because, you know, this is when she was seven. When I was seven, right, I was being abused and neglected. And I had no one, you know, tell me to face my fears or to help me face my fears. And this is why I feel so strongly about making sure that we provide children with an education and how to deal with their emotions.
Indeed, and I want to underscore that, and I can think of, you know, children around the world who are living in such adverse situations and worrying about their emotional life. But I do want to ask you, because, you know, it's not like when we're 24, we stop growing and developing. I mean, as adults, we also have this emotional life, and we have habits from our childhood, and we've got that, you know, that terrible little voice that tells us that we're no good. And I think sometimes our habits get hardened, so we fall into sort of a knee-jerk way of responding to things. How do we loosen up as adults when it comes to our emotional life?
Yeah, well, the first is that you listen to these kinds of conversations and you realize that it's possible. And I do believe that's important. But the good point of this is that everything that's learned can be unlearned. I'm going to say that again. We learned to be the way we are. We can unlearn to be the way we are and learn better ways to be who we are. And so awareness is the first step. You know, checking in, just listening to yourself, noticing like, wow, every time I look in the mirror, I'm critical. That's not cool. How is that helping with my well-being? You know, every time I put on this outfit, I make fun of myself and I think I look terrible. Every time I want to do this, I say, I'm not going to be good at that. We have to really pay attention to, you know, our self-talk, as we were saying. But we also have to know what the alternatives are. And that's important. And there are many alternatives. One is just what we call positive self-talk, which is a saying kind things to oneself. Mark, you can do it. I said that a lot. You know, I have the tendency to be anxious. I have the tendency to be overwhelmed. It's just who I am. And I travel a lot, and, you know, my planes get, you know, canceled, and I'm ready to have my breakdown like my mother had. And I just sit down, I take a deep breath, and I'm like, Mark, you know, this feeling is not permanent. You've been here before. You're upset. But, you know, tomorrow's going to be a sunny day. There are rainy days. There are sunny days. When it's a rainy day, you feel like it's never going to stop raining. But you know that there will be a sunny day coming soon. Oh, my gosh. Wow, that's helpful. But there are tricks. There are techniques that we can learn to help us get out of the kind of hole that we put ourselves in with negative self-talk and help us see the light.
How powerful, influential are our families of origin and how we were raised and what we were taught about emotions? I mean, I came from a family where we really didn't fight. I mean, there wasn't a lot of anger, and even though there, I'm sure everyone was feeling it, but we did not express it. And I mean, as an adult, that's sort of my modus operandi in the world. But nonetheless, I know other families are very different from that.
Yeah. So again, everything about our emotional life is learned, whether it's from teachers or peers or parents or neighbors or aunts or uncles or tennis coaches or football coaches. And so that's important to know. You know, in my research, what I find is that only about 5% of people say they felt they got a formal education about feelings at home, and even fewer at school. So most of us, you know, it's why emotional intelligence, you know, it was only defined about 35 years ago as a concept, and we're just studying it now. People didn't know there was a thing to teach or to help people develop. Now they do. And I think things are changing. People are realizing that, you know, we have to ask people, how are you feeling? I think that part of the challenge we have with families these days is, and this is based on my newest research, that I ask parents this question. I do a lot of training for parents. And I say, what's getting in the way? And listen to this. A lot of parents tell me, you know, Mark, I'm actually afraid to ask my kid how they're feeling.
Wow. Wow.
I say, why? And they say, I'm not sure I can handle what they're going to tell me. And so it goes back to the adults not having the skills. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do to assuage the strong, unpleasant feelings that they think their kids might be having. Importantly, Go ahead, please.
No. Okay, I'll just because I'm looking at the clock, and I will jump in then, which raises, I think, the question about denial, which I think is understandable. But that is such a powerful response to emotions, to deny that they even exist.
Yep.
Why do you think that is? I mean, maybe you answered it. Yeah, but go ahead.
I think, you know, I'm perplexed by that because, you know, as someone who studies this and has been teaching it through, you know, school systems for now 30 years, I just find, like, how could you deny emotions? You know, they're our life force. But they're scary for people. You know, if you've never learned how to deal with anger and you grew up with a parent who was angry all the time, anger is a scary feeling. And so in many ways, it's easier to just ignore the feeling or deny. I think about this in relationships all the time, in couples. I mean, how many couples that I've spoken to where they don't actually tell each other how they really feel about each other because they're afraid of the other person's reaction to the truth. When it's normal for couples and people in different relationships to have anger and sadness and fear and other emotions. And if we could just create a society where people can have open and honest conversations, maybe we'd have fewer divorces and we'd have people who really stayed in relationships with each other and were able to cope with, you know, the downside of that roller coaster ride. So I think that it's the reason why we're at a place where we're at, you know, where the Surgeon General, you know, has caused this, you know, a state of emergency with mental health in terms of the crisis on children and adolescents, is because we have denied ourselves and other people the permission to feel.
Hmm. The loneliness epidemic, I think you were referring to there. How much do unexpressed then emotions show up in stomach aches and headaches and somatic complaints?
There's very strong research to support that. You know, that when, you know, our feelings have to go somewhere, right? We know what they look like when they're externalized. We see that all the time, right? The angry outburst, the yelling, the screaming, you know, or the other kinds of behaviors like the maybe overeating or drinking excessively. But there's also the internalization pieces of it, right? That suppression, that denial that takes a toll on our immune system. And again, what research shows is that when we feel safe and comfortable in expressing those emotions, we see the doctor less often, you know, we have greater resilience, and we have greater well-being, which is what I think everybody wants for themselves and for their children in particular.
When we talk about, you know, listening to our gut, is that where some of our emotions reside?
They do, but as a scientist, I want to be clear that emotions are in our brain and that we are, you know, the gut is providing some information, but emotions are an experience that we have to understand cognitively. And so we're going to, you know, have that feeling, but then we're going to ask ourselves questions about, you know, what's happening right now in my life? You know, what did that person say that just made me feel this way? You know, we're going to try to unpack it and label it so that we know what to do with it.
What do we, meaning us people, us human beings, what do we generally then look for in our leaders? They could be at work, they could be out in the world, when it comes to their emotional intelligence.
Good questions. I love this because we just published a paper on this.
Oh, you did? Okay, well, and you have 30 seconds, Mark, but go ahead. Sorry.
All right. Well, here's the deal.
Okay.
People want to work for someone who is high in emotional intelligence because you are happier, you have less burnout, you are less likely to want to leave your job, you experience less frustration and more creativity and more inspiration when you are in a workplace where you have a leader with higher emotional intelligence.
Which would be what? The ability to be vulnerable, the skills to be authentic, things like that?
Well, it goes back to ruler skills, you know. So the critical skill in our research was the regulation piece, that leaders who are able to manage stress, you know, their own stress management, but also in the interpersonal way, they were able to be emotionally supportive to their teams when you as an employee know that your leader is going to listen to you and be supportive, it makes a huge difference.
Well, we have to leave it there. Mark Brackett, we could go on, but we have to stop our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you so much.
And that is psychologist Mark Brackett, founding director of the Center for Emotional Intelligence at Yale University. His book is titled Permission to Feel, Unlocking the Power of Emotions to Help Our Kids, Ourselves, and Our Society Thrive. Well, thank you for joining us today on The Connection. It airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen to the WHYY app, and you can follow us on Instagram and find us on Facebook. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show, is produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.